Not confined to the past, make sure to etch your own path in the pantheon of human history. This has been Black History Month 365. Bam! 365, where you find every day Black History is made.
You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Coming up next, Technology Bites.
Listeners should be aware that the following program contains language and audio images which may be found disturbing and may not be suitable for your snotty-nosed little brat who probably cusses like a sailor behind your back anyway. Parental discretion is advised.
Missing Geek Formation, it's Technology Bites.
Welcome to Technology Bites. Where's Flicked?
He had to move his van.
Down by the river.
Down by the KPFT parking lot. I lost my Flicked.
No, it's because Flicked double parks if he can't find a parking space. He doesn't like compromising, so he just throws the van in the middle of the parking lot.
It's called overloading in the coding world.
It's alternate parking.
It's definitely something.
It is alternate parking.
It is definitely a thing that he
all
does.
All right. Well, I'm not going to wait. You're welcome. What? You're listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Flicked it outside parking van.
Flicked it not here, man.
It's just not the same.
Yeah. The rhythm is... The rhythm is... Oh, here he comes now.
The rhythm is going to get you.
Don't tell him we're doing a radio show.
Why does Flicked look like he's going to go to a drive-by trucker show?
Why is anything...
He just came from a drive-by trucker show.
On his way to another drive-by trucker show. All right, well, we're glad you could tune in. Welcome to the show. We got Peter Hughes in the studio, so...
Live!
It's going to sound different.
We'll do it live!
I'm Flicked...
Yes, you are.
Now it's perfect.
49 second delay.
There you go.
That's a delay.
And he's got on his Making America Late Again.
I see what you did there. You made America late again. Again!
All right, so visit us online at geekradio.com. That's www.geekradio.com.
Cuckoo.
And you could also go to technologybytes.com if you like to type something a little bit longer. The more formal name of the... We have the formal name URL and then the, hey, we're geeks, Geek Radio URL. We have that card.
Sweet.
If you want to hang out with us on IRC, if you want to chat with us in our chat channel, it's chat.geekradio.com, formerly known as Cuckoo.
Cuckoo.
There you go.
All right. Just on, right on time. Thanks, Groovehouse.
You're welcome.
Beautiful plumage on the IRC channel.
Cuckoo.
There are corners of the chat you don't want to go to. That's one of them.
Making it weird.
That's the corner of the elevator that's been stuck between floors for the last 8 hours. All right, so we're
stuck between here and the Upside Down.
I saw the preview.
Halloween.
This Halloween.
This Halloween.
This Halloween.
Stranger Things Returns.
Yeah, what was the deal with that? Because they just showed like some scenes from the first one, but it's not.
It's a teaser clip.
I thought somebody said that they were done with that, and if they did another one, it would be called Stranger Things, but it would be about something else.
Wish. It's a continuation of the first one.
Yeah, which I'm sad about.
Me too.
Confused. I thought the Stranger Things season 2 was Winona Ryder doing all the faces. That's not.
That was the intermission.
What actually had? Does anyone know what happened? I just assumed she was surprised.
Winona Ryder.
I don't watch a lot of TV stuff, but.
Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. No, okay.
She
was emotional.
She's emoting.
Okay. The theory is that she had no clue what was going on, what was being said.
The speech was talking, it was a politically edged speech. It was anti-bullying, but it was aimed at one particular house in the country, I think. And so that was her.
Now, at some point in some channel, just like, you know, AK-47 style, different pics of Winona Ryder's face started flying by. And I was like, okay, they all look like she's the same thing. What's going on? And I look up and they're all clipped from some award show. That's weird. She's part of our generation. We don't want to lose anyone else. I guess we didn't lose her.
She just made a lot of faces.
All I know, I mean, I just saw what I saw on Twitter. I didn't see the actual thing, but apparently they're giving some speech, some acceptance speech for Stranger Things, and somebody was saying
it
something
was the
emotional.
Screen Actors Guild.
And somebody was saying something important and meaningful, and she was emoting.
We will fight this. We will not accept it.
The SAG Awards, which I just love that. Let's see the fashion at the SAG Awards. Just gives you a nice visual, you know.
Yeah. All right.
The red carpet.
So you can go to geekradio.com. We have all the podcasts and information about upcoming geek gatherings. Although we just had a geek gathering, although it was ill attended because of the Super Bowl, and
I don't think we really announced it on the show before.
But it was the first Friday.
It was the first Friday we had to do it. But I think a lot of people that usually show up that know to show up, they don't have to have it announced to show up. Didn't show up because they didn't want to mess with downtown.
But it wasn't that bad.
It wasn't that bad.
And there was plenty of parking at cons.
Yeah. It was fine. It was good.
Yeah.
But nobody came.
Nobody came.
It's okay.
Jay and Groove didn't cross paths.
We didn't. But I was there.
So it was like two geek gatherings.
And I was at both of them.
You're the bridge over troubled waters. All right, so we...
Jay and I can't be in the same place for very long, so he goes first.
I don't know why you're
later.
Not leaving right now.
Well, we are separated by a wall, so...
That's true. As long as there's two sheets of glass between us,
right.
Then all is well with the world. But if one of these glasses was to go away...
Yeah, if the streams were to be crossed.
And we are going to have a guest tonight.
Oh, right. Tell us about that, Pete.
There's... next week, there is... the Real Abilities Festival, a free arts festival that celebrates art made by Houstonians living with disabilities. That's interesting, but the more technology interesting part is, as part of the festival, they're having Up Abilities, a thought leadership conference with some well-known personalities. One is Henry Evans, a man who will be conducting his talk on robotics via telepresence. And then another is a lady game designer, Jane McGonigal, who will be discussing how video games can enrich the lives of people living with disabilities. And so we're going to have the main person for Up Abilities We'll be calling in a little bit later. The actual event, so you can, it's kind of a TED type talk thing.
Not to be confused with a Teddy talk.
TED style. The actual event is, and we'll talk more about it when we have the guest on, but the actual event is on Thursday, the 16th of February. So next Thursday will be the actual event, and I believe it's free to the public. So if you're interested, you'll be able to, find out more about it. And so that'll be coming up in the first half hour of the show.
And that's the news.
First half hour.
All right, so let's
get to that, Pete.
There's so much news this week.
So are we going to do the info shot? And when we wrap that up, hopefully we'll have the call in the queue when she calls in to be on the air, and we'll do that segment after the news. So take it away, info shot.
It's the Technology Bytes Info Shot. Technology news and commentary by Peter Hughes. Injected directly into your skull.
Okay, there is just a ton of news tonight. We'll do some and then probably get to the guest and then pick back up. So frankly, there is so much news tonight that if there's stuff where somebody wants to speak up on and talk about it, I don't want it to get buried after, a bunch of different stories. Just doing a few real simple ones. This one I thought was good. There was an article in Wired on how to keep Amazon Echo and Google Home from responding to your TV set, to the commercials. Because there's been a lot of events where, there was a Google commercial during the Super Bowl that prompted Home to play whale noises, flip the hallway lights on, and recite a substitute for cardamom. As a series of actors barked OK Google commands on TV, the devices started doing what they were asked to do. Obviously, Google is not evil, so they didn't have it, order you pizza or do anything else that would cost you something. Android phones with Google Assistant may have done the same thing. Google Home wasn't haunted, it was just doing its job. So they do give you the answers on what to do. We talked a bit, we didn't talk about it from this point of view, but one thing is that on each assistant there is a microphone switch. There's a physical switch, so you can actually turn it off. Of course, the problem is then the next time that you want to use it, or other members of your household that don't realize you've turned it off, then you kind of get them reenacting the Scotty scene from Star Trek 4.
Computer? Oh, a keyboard. A friend of mine, he's an older gentleman, in his 70s, and he got an Amazon Echo, and he loves to talk to technology. He talks to his Google phone, he talks to the Amazon Echo, and he just carries on with it, just asking questions all the time. And I told her about the mute button. I said, if you get tired of it, just here's a mute button. He'll never figure it out in a million years. Just mute it, and it won't respond to him. So if you want to play a trick on someone, walk over to their Amazon Echo and just press the button. It'll stop responding.
It's great at parties because they have no idea who did it, but then they're going to show off their thing. So, Alexa, change the music.
Alexa!
God, that's the kind of thing that lets people throw away their technology and just buy new ones.
People would, and that way that. You get a free Alexa.
Hey!
You hang out after the party. You're like,
I'm dumpster diving after the show tonight.
Can I have it for give this thing to me. I'll just use it for electronic parts and stuff because that's what I do.
For right now, that's the only way to stop Google Home from responding to your TV's whims. Home responds to two wake phrases, and both of them are always active. OK Google and Hey Google. Whenever it hears either of those
phrases. What are those phrases, Pete? Again, louder?
OK Google, order me a pizza.
I have an Alexa. Oh, actually, I have two, and they were in the same room, and so I had to change the name, so one of them I named Echo. But then the other one got moved, but then they added the ability to call it computer. And I was like, well, I don't really like calling it Echo, and Amazon seems kind of stupid. I'm going to change it to computer. That's a horrible mistake.
Yeah, because you say I
say computer a lot.
That lasted for about a day at my place, and I changed them back. It was really novel because I felt very Star Trek, but it's not practical. No. I'll be on the phone, and suddenly stuff starts going on in the conference call, and it's no good.
And then what was it? This was the worst point. The low point for me was I was talking to my wife, and I said, "Yeah, something the computer." Everything on it is something, and all of a sudden the echo goes, "Everything was something" by some stupid country artist, Blake Shelton, and it started playing. And I'm like, "Computer, stop!" And then it wouldn't listen to me, so I had to listen to like 40 seconds of the song before it would stop.
Rise of the Machines.
Oh my! So on the Alexa, as you may have picked up from our conversation already, you can use the alternate wake word to lessen the chance, because obviously in their commercials they're going to kind of stick to a particular one, but you can choose Alexa, Amazon, Echo, or computer,
or dot.
Or dot.
Dot?
It's not listed there, but it's dot's one of the wake words.
It is allowed on
really?
The
how
shows
you,
up on
how
the
how do you do it
settings.
Because it wasn't
you go into just go in. Well, I do it on my Android handset, but I just go in.
I didn't see
you
it
pick
as...
out the one and then settings and then wake word. It's in there.
Oh really? I
so
just
got
remember
one
the
in
other
dot
ones
that I try to call Echo.
No, I know dot was
like,
one.
Echo,
of them.
Echo. Oh, dot. Like, oops.
Yeah, well,
spiders.
Yeah, so that's your four options. They talk about the problem with the computer, that you realize how many times you say that word. There are third-party Alexa devices coming to market soon, such as LG's Hub Robot, which will purportedly let you customize wake words and even respond to the voices of different individual humans. So there's that. I guess while we're talking about Amazon, this one, you know, we talked about, mentioned the kind of, I guess, sort of Amazon... the sort of stop-and-go type store where you wouldn't have... there wouldn't be a cashier and you'd just, like, walk in and take your stuff off the shelf and go. Well, there is some employment involved with those. I mean, it's not a totally non-human experience, but it sounds like, you know, it sounds like that they may expand it nationally. And according to the New York Post, Amazon plans to mandate that future supermarket-sized versions of its automated Go stores have a maximum of 10 employees staffing any given location. Huh. So on average, the company plans to use 6 people per shift, the report states, with Amazon relying on robotic automation and software to do most of the heavy lifting. You know, oddly enough, that's actually 3 more people than Walmart has on a shift. Nah, just kidding. And no robots. No, but as part of a new 2-story layout for future Go supermarkets, a staff of anywhere from 3 to 10 employees would keep things running. The Post reports that one employee could be used to stock shelves, while another could act as a manager for guest services, which may include signing up customers for Amazon Fresh grocery delivery. 2 additional employees would be used to oversee drive-through windows, while another 2 would aid robotic grocery bagging machines at prep orders and deliver them to customers on conveyor belts.
Yeah, but somebody would—they would have to have somebody there to do. What's that? What's that called? When people steal stuff?
Oh, loss prevention.
Yeah, they'd have to have like at least 1 or 2 people for loss prevention, right?
I know, because there's nobody doing checkout. It's that you go and you know, pick out your stuff that you're going to buy, or pick up your pre-existing order, and so. I think if
but
you
how
go
would
in
it...
there and stuff everything in your pockets, it's that the store is set up where with cameras and other stuff, if you take stuff off the shelf,
it's got to be loss prevention. Somebody,
but
right
if you but if you wear like you know like a RF like
a Faraday cage,
a Faraday jacket, you know you could just stuff a bunch of stuff in there and it wouldn't be able to
come
know it was
in
your
big,
jacket.
This big sort of dome shaped coat that glides along the floor. Well, if there are people there, I'm sure that's part of what the
first thing.
Say anything about having greeters.
The first thing you get at the store,
you have to have. They're thinking
is
of
a big thing of Reynolds wrap. Then you just go around wrapping everything you want.
They're gonna say, they're gonna say, "Geez, that Faraday cage sale idea was really a bad." Now let's see. Where was I? The ultimate goal is to cut down on labor costs and further remove unnecessary human interaction from the physical shopping experience. You know the problem is? The humans that I really would like to see removed from the shopping experience is everybody other else shoppers. In the aisles of the thing. If you go to a grocery store on the weekends, if you've ever done that, you go to a grocery store on the weekend, it's old home week. First off, they bring the entire family, and then the whole brood stops in the middle of the aisle to talk to the other family that I'm assuming they probably saw about 15 minutes earlier, but now they really need to have a... You know, when they left their homes, then now they run into them and then have a whole reunion thing right there in the middle of the aisle between you and whatever.
So what they do, what they need to do is they need to create this store where robots get everything, and then they just give you VR goggles, and you just sit down and you go through the store, and you're the only one in the store.
There you go. That could work. The Post reports that Amazon is thinking of requiring a Prime membership to enter its stores to curb the potential for shoplifting. Oh, it says...
You'll have your Prime membership tattooed on your forehead.
It could also employ greeters to stand near the entrance to ensure people don't grab items without first scanning their Amazon account at the entrance. I think they should have big metal doors that shut towards the inside. And so then if somebody does the grab and run, it's just...
Well, you know those new Intel drone squads that they debuted at the Super Bowl would descend and branch out and corner you in the mall.
So it's apparently, though, right now it's unclear how many employees staff the current Go store in Seattle. It's also unclear how Amazon plans to expand its physical retail in general beyond the select handful of brick-and-mortar bookstores it currently operates. When reached by the Post, Amazon denied that it's planning to build two-story Go stores. In a statement given to The Verge, Amazon said, as we told the New York Post, we have no plans to build such a store, and their story is incorrect. Just other rumors. These have been denied, so no, I'm not fake newsing you, but some of it is when somebody reports something and it gets denied, that doesn't necessarily make it fake news.
I, on the other hand, might be fake newsing people.
There was a report last December in the Wall Street Journal that said that they planned to open more than 2,000 retail locations covering a variety of store sizes and formats. The Post says that despite this, that they are indeed planning a gradual rollout of more stores in varying sizes by as early as late 2017. So don't be camping out for your Amazon store. There already are dozens of pop-up kiosks around the country focusing on informing people about Alexa devices and selling Prime.
They have one of those in Baybrook Mall.
So it would make sense for the Go model if it does indeed provide a benefit consumers truly want. It's an interesting concept. So you know, of course, the downside is again, there's not going to be a ton of jobs in it, but that's worth watching for. Do we have our guest? As if they called
in? Yeah, we sure do.
Can't really see the.
We do.
So why don't we pause. Put a fork in the news and. And we'll bring on our guest. Her name is Cheryl Rapp, and this is the reading a bit from her bio. She travels the world in search of people who are passionate about sharing extraordinary messages. Through years of producing the UP experience, she learned to recognize those with the intangible it factor. So, this is should be a you know, the talk that's coming up that we'll find out more.
And by it means IT, right?
for people with disabilities, yes. But so let's bring in our guest. Hey, Cheryl, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, very good. I gave a halfway. Halfway description, but is there a better way? How would you like to describe what the UP experience is?
Well, we started, my husband and I, about 8 years ago creating an event in Houston where we brought in 16 thought leaders from all over the world that spoke for 20 minutes each. And we had about 1,000 people in the audience and 500 kids down the hall for the Junior Up experience. And it was just an incredible day of an intellectual experience like none other. And we've had a lot of fun with that. We've recently, well, I guess the last few years, created custom up experiences for corporations and nonprofits that are interested in bringing in experts that can share their passionate story and expertise and impact some kind of change in an audience. So Up Abilities was created in that custom up experience.
Awesome. Is this the first year that Up Abilities is being done at here in Houston, or?
Actually, this will be the third year. So Real Abilities Film Festival, which is unbelievable. And to be honest with you, I had not participated prior to being asked to create this event. But this is really one of the most heartwarming weeks of the year in Houston, where these amazing films are showed. It's a free citywide festival. And it promotes inclusion, and it celebrates the lives and the stories and just incredible talents of people living with disabilities. So this is the fifth year of the Real Abilities Film Festival. The first year, a bunch of the people involved had actually been to the Up Experience, and they came to me and asked if I could create an event where I brought in 3 or 4 experts that had disabilities that could share their stories and promote inclusion throughout the community. So I said, well, how interesting. I've never booked a speaker with a disability, and I really didn't know the right way to go about that. But I started researching. I attended conferences all over. I uncovered this amazing community of people that just had the most inspiring and incredible stories. So I brought them to Houston the first year, and it blew them away the last night, and now I've become the opening night of the Real Abilities Film Festival called Up Abilities.
Oh, awesome. So that's the kickoff next Thursday.
So you said it was citywide. Hi, this is Jay. I just wanted to jump in. You said this is a citywide event. So how many different locations are participating?
Well, actually, all the films, there are 15 total films, are being shown at the Edwards Greenway Grand Palace Stadium. So all the films are just amazing. They are curated films where they open up discussion of what's being expressed in the films, and they're just brilliant. So those are going on all at Edwards Greenway Grand Plaza, and everything is free. The parking at Edwards is free. It's just all about inclusion. Our night, the opening night, is at the Shepherd School of Music at Rice University, and that will be on the 14th with a reception at 6:15 and the program starting from 7 to 9.
Okay, well, we're going to, for any listeners on it, we're posting links to on our website with where you can get more information so that in case people have been frantically trying to write down.
There are so many things too that it's great to go to the website, because there are a few new things this year. They're having previews of the festival with the Houston Ballet, which is exciting, and that's on Valentine's Day, February 14th. That's exciting. They have this a whole new art program where they're showcasing art, a celebration company, and that's actually, it started January 30th, and that goes, I'm not sure where that goes through, but it's amazing. And then Real Children, where they're showing films at the Children's Museum, and then it ends with Real Music, and I actually attended this last year. It's an all-inclusive jazz and blues kind of jam session with the pros, and then they're bringing up musicians that have disabilities up on the stage. And that will actually be at the Secret Group on Polk. So other than those events, everything else, all the films will be shown at Edwards, which is great.
Okay, awesome. So it looks like you have several interesting speakers for this. And I in the summary I got, it talked about somebody who's going to be speaking by telepresence. I didn't realize until I looked a little closer to the show that the reason is because he can't really attend in person, right? Henry Evans.
Yeah, so Henry Evans, it was actually in 2003, became a quadriplegic and mute before a stroke, and it was ended up something he had at birth and never realized. So at 40 years old, and he was this big CEO at Silicon Valley, was left all of a sudden disabled, and he was always into high-tech companies, and he has just embraced technologies that are just helpful to the disabled, to the elderly, helping really all of them to participate in mainstream society. And he focuses on five technologies. And yes, we are beaming him in. So I don't know if you've ever seen the Beam robot, but it's amazing.
That's and that he one is, that goes around on its own set of wheels. And
yes,
yeah.
He's actually controlling it with his eyes from his bed in Silicon Valley. And he will be presenting on these five technologies that are helping everyone overcome disabilities. And it's just, it's amazing. These robots he uses all over the world through museums and events that he wants to participate in and can't be there. And it's really, you know, you had mentioned drones earlier. He's a big proponent of drones being where he can't be so he can see what's going on. And it's just, it's incredible the remote presence devices he uses just to, you know, to help with disabled people or bedridden people experience the world.
Is there a component of this event that involves like a showroom floor or anything where companies are demonstrating technologies or utilities that are used by by disabled people to help integrate them into the workforce or into society? Is there anything like that where companies that are specializing in tech are going to be showing what they make for this?
I mean, what a fabulous idea. I did that at the Up Experience, but at an event like this, we are not. But that's a wonderful idea.
It would just be real curious. You know, I mean, I'm sure the speakers will be covering this in some of the presentations that they'll be making about how they do it. But, I mean, it might be nice to talk to vendors that are, you know, because I know there's a lot of, well, not necessarily a lot of talk, but there's some talk about, you know, usability of tech and being able to, you know, make websites that are compatible for people that are, you know, have vision problems or have other handicaps that might, you know, make it difficult for them to interact with even just the internet and to make stuff more usable for everybody, not just people that are regularly abled.
Absolutely. No, it is absolutely right. And that's really what this whole event and Real Abilities is all about, is education.
I think, you know, overall people may not, you know, have that awareness. So it sounds like an event like this brings that to the forefront and could empower people to interact more, you know, positively with people with disabilities and for employers to be, you know, to hire people and to accommodate those needs in the workplace, and that there's ways to go about that to make it more inclusive. So that sounds really interesting.
Absolutely.
All right. Did you have some more questions, Pete?
Well, I guess so. There's, you know, interesting, you know, Henry Evans obviously is a consumer of, you know, he uses the technology himself, and mm-hmm. so that should be interesting to hear his experience. And then I guess another guest that's more on the technology side of it is Jane McGonigal.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like she's a game designer and director of game research and development with the Institute for the Future in Palo Alto, California. What's she going to be talking about?
I mean, she's fabulous. And in fact, I had her at one of the Up Experiences about 6 or 7 years ago. And she is, wow, she's going to reveal decades worth of scientific research, really into the ways that all games, and that includes, you know, everything from puzzles to video games to sports, how they change really how we respond to stress, challenge, pain, disabilities, and how this gameful mindset helps to heal and eliminate all kinds of things, depression, just strengthening relationships. It's so funny, all these myths about your children are spending too much time gaming, and she has proof over the last 15, 20 years of all these advantages of gaming and how they're so important to our health. And it's a brilliant talk. She's also going to be interviewing a local celebrity, Michael Beejum, who is a quadriplegic, who is an incredible gamer that's won all kinds of awards in Texas, playing with his mouth. So it's going to be an incredible and inspiring evening, and hopefully you'll walk away with a different perspective.
Sounds like it. You know, for anybody who's, the TED thing, you have to wait for the video. You have to wait for the video afterwards, unless you're a CEO and have a fortune. This one you can go for free, and see it live, and experience something that just sounds like a very different way to look and think about technology. And we're glad to help kind of get the word out on this program.
So we have all the links up at geekradio.com. And so if you want to go check it out and learn more about it, so when does this kick off? What's the start date on this next week?
Yes, next Thursday, February 16th.
All right.
Awesome.
Awesome.
Well,
thank you so much. We really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for calling in and being a part of the show tonight.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right.
Yeah, we've had, we should have mentioned it beforehand, but, over the years, I mean, we've had we've had people have called in who are using technology to. There's David, among others who've called
young in David. And, he's actually
he's not so young anymore.
Not so young anymore. No, he's David showed up to a couple of geek gatherings, and he's blind. He's legally been completely blind, and. Just how he interacts with technology is just fascinating to watch and to see how he's, that there is technology out there that's designed to...
He gets great battery life.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have to
power... Because most of the energy is the power and display.
Yep. Yeah.
I think he needs a laptop that doesn't have a screen, that just has two keyboard processor bases with batteries,
yeah.
Well, hinged in the middle. And
it's interesting
to
watch him compute because he has the shell closed on his fingers, and he reaches inside the
It's very hackery. It's like, okay, no one can see what I'm doing. It's like I can either get under a blanket like Snowden, or I'll just do this.
Well, for him, I don't even know if it's conscious or not. But you're not going to shoulder surf anything on the screen. Mm-hmm. And you're not going to shoulder surf his finger movements either, so you're not going to see what password he types in or if you can count finger
and
strokes.
And it screen reads, but it screen reads so fast, it's hard to understand what it's saying either.
So even if you're not disabled or you don't have any use for this kind of technology now, I do think that it's going to be extremely important because all of us are aging. I think so. Yeah. I don't think there's going to be, a lot of, young force of, young Cabana boys and girls and whatever to take care of us. I think it's going to be robotic assistance. I think it's going to be augmented, where's my car keys? Where's my medication? All that kind of stuff.
I think there could be a schism there because it's like, hey, I'm disabled. I'm not old. All right. So I'm glad we had that segment. And we will, do we still have more news to carry on with?
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch.
There's a bunch of news. Peace lamenting how much...
Take before. Or...
Oh, did we have a caller in the queue, Groove House?
Yeah, but we're still doing the news.
What's no, we going can do
on?
A call
in the middle of the news.
Poor fellow's been waiting.
We had an interview in the middle of the news.
He's been waiting. They for were quite part of the time, news. It looks like.
Oh, let's take the call.
Don't make him wait.
Hey, nope. Groove House. Hey,
nope.
You're
show.
In charge.
You're in charge. Your show. I'm going to let it through.
All right.
In the middle of the news, we're going to take a call, and this is Cliff.
Hey, Cliff, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
We're crazy.
Crazy.
I understand that. Thank you very much, and I enjoyed listening to all this anyway, so
writing
is no problem. I have a 2007 iMac, and over the years it's gotten extremely slow, and I don't find any Apple fixes or you know, like defragging on a PC or anything.
Cliff, is this the white plastic iMac or the first-gen aluminum iMac?
Aluminum. Okay. The 20-inch screen.
Okay.
And I'm suspicious of any non-Apple, these other software people that says they can fix all your problems, and I don't know whether I should just dump it and get something else, but
it seems
to me that every time the operating system upgrades, it gets slower.
It's it does. I think that's a very accurate statement. The newer operating systems, while not as bad in the Mac world as it is, say, in the Windows world, the new Mac operating systems require a little bit more oomph each time you
upgrade.
Have you?
I don't know about that. Have you peaked on that one? Like, can you run Sierra? Or
yes.
Did you get stuck?
No, they can still.
No, I'm on Yosemite.
Okay, so
I'm trying to remember what the
because I have a first gen MacBook Air, and that's the Atom processor, and the last one I think I could jump to was 10.7.
No, hold on. I was just reading about this. Okay, so you can't use Sierra. Sierra is the late 2009 iMac or later. So Yosemite is where he's gonna peak.
Yosemite's
at.
Recent though. So
yeah. It's the previous one. Well, yeah. Cliff, one thing that you might consider doing if you have only done upgrades every time, like every time a new version of macOS comes out, if you've only done an upgrade, what you might consider doing is kind of take a page from the Windows playbook and do a wipe and a fresh, clean install of a brand new copy of Yosemite, and then do a time machine restore of just your documents and your programs and stuff. That'll clean out a lot of the garbage that may have accumulated without, you'll still have all your stuff.
Right.
The other thing, how big is the hard drive in that? Because it probably wasn't so big in the first place.
It's probably a 512 gig.
No, 4 gigabyte is the...
That's RAM.
That's RAM.
It's RAM.
It's probably 512 gigs. You can find out. Just go up to the Apple menu and go to About This Mac, and it'll tell you in there.
Well, I mean, the hard drive space is...
The thing I was going to say is, especially if the drive is small, you can get an equivalent sized solid-state drive, and you'll get a nice little performance.
Yeah,
but that's a heck of an upgrade to try to pull off on a unibody.
I've done that upgrade. It's a little hairy.
The iMac one, don't you have to get those suction cups?
You got to get the suction. You really need four hands. It's a four-hand upgrade.
There's a video of how to do it if you Google.
I mean, you could replace the hard drive,
iMac,
and you
might an iMac upgrade. You
I think it'll. I think that one will go to 8 megs. Will it go to 8 megs?
What,
I mean, 8 gigs
RAM?
Of RAM?
Yeah, it'll do 8 gigs of RAM.
So, I mean, as just an interim, helper, if you're running on 4 gigs of RAM, you could get 4 more gigs of RAM or, whatever the configuration is.
Well,
I maxed what it said I could do when I bought it.
I'm sorry, say that again?
I maxed out when I bought the thing, I maxed out all the memory that I could.
Oh, you did.
You might check though, because on some of those, sometimes like a model come out and they'll say this is the maximum amount of memory, but then later on they'll come out with a new version or they'll just tweak that one and they'll go back and they'll say, well, it was never actually. Sometimes they actually will change what it supports. They'll actually come back and they'll never say it, but other companies. We'll try it. It'll handle
eight.
The
deal is, if I remember right on this model, it's got a soldered in 2 gigs.
No. Oh, because it's the 21.
And then you can only put one.
It's the 21 inch.
And so I think the maximum you can go to is, instead of, you've probably got a 2 gig module that was put in, you could substitute a 4 gig module and get up to 6 gigs of RAM. I don't know that that's going to give you.
No, your best bet, honestly, Cliff, unless you want to start ripping out hardware and throw a solid state disk in there, which, like I said, that's a four-hand, two-person job. Just make sure you've got a good time machine backup and verify it. Don't just trust that it's run. Check it out. Make sure you got a good backup and then wipe that thing off. You can download the. I think from the Apple Store, the Apple App Store, the one in the Apple menu, you can get the reinstall Yosemite app in there, and it'll download the operating system, whatever. Just wipe it out, flatten the hard drive, put a whole new load on there, and then restore your Time Machine backup, and that should get you. I mean, there's really not that much else you can do without starting to replace hardware. Once you've reloaded the operating system, that's kind of the extent of the voodoo you can do.
With Yosemite, you may have a recovery partition.
It may be on there. I always just pull it down. But yeah, maybe
you can. But you just reinstall and have it boot to the recovery partition, and then you
want to do the internet thing. Do the internet download.
I guess it. Yeah,
doesn't it do
I
that?
I think that's what it does. And you can basically, it gives you disk tools, and you can wipe the drive, and then have it.
Well, my first iMac was a 2009 iMac, and even after reloading it and everything, it still seemed kind of sluggish and like it just didn't quite have the oomph for modern applications.
You've definitely gotten your money's worth out of
plus
that.
Time,
so,
you know, time has marched on, so but it's also possible that it seems snappy back then.
Sounds to me like I should buy another computer.
I would say yes, buy a new computer. Normally, I don't like that to be my answer.
If you're asking for permission because you want somebody else to say
yes,
I say yes.
Yes, yeah. If that's okay, I mean, if you're not put off by the idea of going out and buying a new computer and reloading it with your
put your backup 10 years.
Ten years
is good.
Yeah, that's good, man.
I'd probably have someone else do all the reloading or transferring.
That's easy. If Time Machine makes that super easy.
You,
I promise it's easy.
If you wipe it and reinstall, though, that there is still some value. You may be able to get a couple $100 out of that. Towards your new computer.
Yeah, or donate it. You can get a couple $100 worth of tax write-off, donate it to a school.
You know.
Yeah.
If nothing else, you know, a new computer, you know, after 10 years is I would imagine, would be a really amazing experience. And I would also consider going from 21 to the 27-inch.
I don't think do they have a 21?
I don't know if they still make a 21.
Hold on, let me check.
I
would have gone to the 27-inch, except it was going to take me another week, and I was impatient.
I get that.
I really like my 27-inch iMac that I got a couple of years ago. It's just, you know, I got it with the terabyte hybrid SSD drive, so it boots up really fast. It's really smooth running, and you know, I upgrade every you know, well, with the Mac, it's like about every 5 or 6 years now that I upgrade, but I think 10 years I would be pretty much through with that thing and treat myself. It just depends on your financial situation. You could certainly nurse this one along, and it'll still be a useful piece of equipment. You know, you are running towards, you know, the later years on the hardware life. You could start to see system breakdowns.
They did I mean, the latest OS, they're now not supporting it. So you've reached the end of the road as far as, you know, you can't go up to Yosemite. I mean, you can't go up to Sierra. So, I mean, they're still,
I
think they're still pushing out Yosemite updates.
They are, yeah.
But that will probably end within a year or two.
That's now two out, because that was Yosemite, then El Capitan, and then Sierra.
Maybe it does.
Right?
Well, anyway, Cliff, if I love what Flicted said. If you're looking for permission to buy new hardware, you officially have it. You have persevered, and we are okay with that, sir.
Permission, I don't need. what you would probably do is something that I would want to go with. I guess the only other thing is, would you stick with a Mac or would you go back to a PC?
Sir, do you like your Mac? Because if you like your Mac, stick with your Mac.
You can.
Do you have money? Is the real question. Yeah, well, Mac's not expensive.
Well, that's the question. I can afford it, but you know, there is a difference.
I mean, you're comfortable with it. You know how it works. There's no need switching to a Windows. The only reason I would switch to a Windows computer is if I was looking to get more for my money, you know, in terms of processing power and all of that.
And if you want to get into playing a lot of games, those are still,
well,
I mean, they've been doing better, but it's still better.
I use it for day-to-day stuff, and so I'm not looking for that.
Yeah,
and
no,
in that realm, I don't know whether obviously I would pay a premium to get a laptop, but
actually compared to getting an iMac, especially if you're talking to 27,
I'm looking at it right now. They're
you can get a MacBook Air for under $1,000, which you can't get an iMac. You can't get the desktop type thing. I guess a Mac Mini, but that would still be pushing it. You know, think about, I guess one of the things to do, you have a little bit of time, you know, you've had 10 years of using this. a lot has changed in the computer biz since then. You know, think about what how you're using it. If you're just mostly consuming content, you could even consider a really like an iPad Pro or something.
Maybe, yeah.
Or, and again, a laptop. If
but if you're thinking about a Mac Mini, I would say you've waited 10 years. Wait at least another month, because the Mac Mini, they have not updated in over 2 years, and a lot of people think that I mean, they haven't done anything. No processor updates, nothing. There's a rumors that in March they might bump it to something new, but they're thinking if they don't, then they're probably just going to let that product die.
I think it's going to die.
And my experience with working at it, using with deploying minis at a business,
I wouldn't mess
and
with that.
They had more problems. iMacs don't have problems.
Yeah.
And minis. I actually have
a couple of minis. I haven't really had problems.
Yeah, but don't complicate
people
your
they
life.
They worked fine and worked, you know, was great. Some of them, but there's too high a percentage of them that were just flaky because it wasn't people doing anything odd with it, and the behavior was just not typical.
Or else
it spread. You'd see one of them would start to be flaky.
Get Mac Mini
and then
cancer.
Somebody later would have the same problem, which I think
just
same defense.
Cliff, roll down to your nearest Apple store. Take a stroll around. Look and see what tickles you. You know, everything's going to be a little different if you haven't been in for a while. There's, you know, different. The iMacs all have. I think you can get them without 4K and 5K displays on the very, very bottom end. But everything they're going to have out in the store is going to have the fancy 5K Retina displays. They're going to look really, really nice. Go and see what you like, and then pick something up. It's been long enough, and
if you
don't want to worry about, I mean, don't think about switching to Windows unless you are prepared to change, you know, kind of change up your life and change how you use the computer and learn new shortcuts and learn new applications. And, you know, if that sounds exciting to you and you want to embark on that adventure, then knock yourself out.
But if you go to get one of the other things, if you haven't been pricing stuff since 2007, is if you get a MacBook Air for $1,000,
it's the thin
bucks,
one, yeah. The thin
you
laptop.
You can get a monitor if you're wanting to use it in a desktop type approach. You can get a 24 or even a 27 inch monitor is only going to be a couple hundred bucks for a decent one.
It's true.
So you can have the kind of best of both worlds if you want to vary between the kind of laptop and desktop.
Yeah,
setup.
But you can't beat that simplicity of that all-in-one iMac. I do still love that design.
You can't sit on the couch with your iMac.
I mean, you could.
So would it be possible to, if the monitor's still good in that old iMac,
no,
to get a laptop and use it as a monitor?
No, not.
Not on the 21.
Not on the 21.
On the 27, you could.
Those first ones.
But you can't do that anymore.
Nope.
Yeah,
oh,
they
really?
Do it on the 5K.
Yeah.
There's not, because there's not enough bandwidth in the, I guess in, there's not enough bandwidth consistently across all of the different laptop models to drive the display. There is on the high end, but not at the low end. So no, you can't recycle that display. So I think you're probably set. If you want to pick up something, it sounds like you're probably ready to go.
And if you'd like to buy us one,
just swing it by the station here.
You could buy a couple of different ones for different crew members here, and we could give you our you know, unbiased review of which one you should get for yourself after that.
Hey, there you go.
We'd be happy to provide that service for you.
I think I'll upgrade the Mac. My wife has a 2014 Inspiron, Dell Inspiron, but I don't like it.
Nope.
And she no longer uses it.
You don't have to like it. You know what? If you're used to what you're used to, there's nothing. I mean,
there's nothing.
Honestly, the price, you know, you hear about the Apple tax and the difference in price, and with an all-in-one, when you factor in the cost of the display, and there's really not a premium anymore. Maybe a teeny bit, but honestly, the margins they're dragging are not ridiculous, and it's not like you're paying out the nose for the Apple logo.
Plus the laptops, like once the other company started making like solid body aluminum laptops like that, all of a sudden everybody else's competitor prices were pretty much what Apple's were at always.
So you're good. You would be good to go.
I don't know how we can tell you anymore. I mean, the only thing you got left to do now is try to get to the store in the next seven minutes before they close down. Buy it online. I will say this. One thing to consider if you're looking to save a little bit of money is that you could probably buy a refurb from Apple.com.
Yeah, you could.
Or you could buy an older model from someplace like Adorama or one of those websites, and you wouldn't have to pay sales tax.
Or you could buy a brand new one and keep it for 10 more years.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was thinking, there were two reasons I wasn't too interested in Maryland's Inspiron is I don't get 10 more years, and I don't like it anyway with, I don't know, whatever it is, 7.
Windows 10,
so I think you've got me set. I'm going to go to Apple and sit down with them and talk with them. And, hey, I thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
You also. Thanks.
Thank you. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And another 10 years, you can call us up and see about your VR unit that'll be embedded in your brain.
You've got to upgrade to the neural interface snap-in plug, which goes, you can get the one in the temple or the one in the back of your head. But
no, they're
going to
upgrade
bandwidth.
That next month. I would wait. Yeah.
So the next caller is this guy's wife, and she'd like to have... No,
yes, there is.
She has words for us.
10 more years.
What was that book? It had to either have been... Neil Stevenson or
Snow Crash?
Or William Gibson.
Cryptonomicon.
It was one of those two, but there was a character they had a jacks into the back of
Johnny
their
Mnemonic?
Head. It wasn't. Maybe Johnny Mnemonic was based on this, but in the book, one of them had, you know, was an early adopter, and so he was going in to do something
and
to
his,
get
and
on.
And it sucked. It wouldn't work.
And there was like younger kids that had them, and when he came in, and they were just like, oh man, look at that neural connector, like that thing is ancient. I haven't seen one of those in forever.
It's
and
like
you know,
got
there's
a
like
parallel
super small
porn hanging
like...
off your neck.
The Matrix 4.
I don't remember what book that was, though. I just remember reading that they, you know, they were making fun of him because he had this like large clunky connector on the back of his, and theirs were like, you know, super sleek, small.
What do you do if you have that and you lose like the dust cap?
Your eye starts twitching.
You.
All right, well, we're getting close to the top of the hour. We're going to have to take a break, so we got a call in the queue. I'll have to take that after the break, I suspect.
And then finish the episode-long news segment.
The
news forever!
There's a lot of... All right, well, there's
there
the
it
music.
Is.
There it is. All right, so that music tells us we have to take a short break, so we're going to take a short break due to the music telling us to do so. We're going to do some station business, and we'll be back after... the station business. You are listening to Technology Bytes. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Plicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Lee.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Cuckoo.
AIDS Walk Houston 2017 takes place on Sunday, March 5th at 1 p.m. at Sam Houston Park in downtown Houston, 1000 Bagby Street. The approximately 1.8-mile walk is produced by AIDS Foundation Houston Incorporated and benefits local AIDS service organizations striving to make an impact in the fight against AIDS and HIV. Post-walk festivities include live entertainment, great food trucks, kid zone activities, and sponsor booths. Proceeds from the walk support over 90,000 Houstonians each year, providing them with education, pediatric programs, housing, food, medical care, counseling, and job training. For more information, visit AIDSHelp.org. KPFT Houston.
K
KPFT is seeking local organizations, businesses, and individuals to take part in our Community Partners program. Community Partners help KPFT through supporting initiatives of the station, reducing our pledge drives, and being key contributors to our success. As a community partner, your organization or business becomes invested in a richer way in KPFT. You help keep important independent radio flowing. Interested in becoming a community partner? Just call 713-526-4000 or visit kpft.org. Thanks for your interest in our Community Partners program. This is KPFT Houston.
You're listening to 90.1 FM, KPFT Houston. We now return to Technology Bites.
This is Technology Bites.
Beep boop.
All right. Well, we
here, just a second. I was trying to get this to work, and it wouldn't load. So here, let me do this. Just a second.
KPFT.
Oh, that's
good. The wrong one. Here, let me try.
Come on now.
Let me try this. Watch.
KPFT Houston. We've got a bunch of geeks with laptops in the studio ready to answer your computer and technology questions. And they're a lot friendlier than your average office IT guy. Get the help you need now by calling 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-KPFT. Or log on to geekradio.com and join the IRC chat. And now, Technology Bites.
I'm usually like.
When was that done?
Yeah, I've never heard that before.
That's been. You played that before, haven't you?
I've never heard it before.
I seem to recall it, but I can't recall if I recall it or not.
I've never heard such a thing.
They can't read that.
Those letters are too tiny. Just I cannot read the fiery
what
letters.
Say somebody sent it to us.
Oh man, that's from 2010. That was Mike McGuff's.
Oh, nice, yeah. Mike McGuff.
It was good. I like that.
Yeah, it was played before. I remember
now.
Yeah, we did
because I remember I gave him grief about IRC chat,
and like ATM machine.
And he got me for something else that I used it myself, I think, and I said IRC chat, and so yeah. Doodle doodle doo doodle doodle doo. That was going to be our new intro, maybe, but nah. No.
Yeah, we used it for a while.
We tried it on, yeah, for a month or two.
It kind of chafed us a little.
Beep boop beep boop.
Beep boop. All right, Groovehouse.
Yeah.
Who do we have next in the news interruption lineup?
Up next in the news interruption lineup, it is Mohammed.
Mohammed, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Yeah, so, yeah.
Turn down your radio.
Please.
Wow, we are funny.
Wow. We used it for a while.
I think you may have walked away.
I'll get it circled back to you.
All right, drop the call.
All right.
All right, Mohammed. If you want to call back, Mohammed, you'll have to call back in and turn your radio down.
Here, Mohammed, here, how about this?
Technology Bites will be right back.
is that an actual like modem? If we play that, will it try to train up against something?
I have no idea.
All right,
I've got one here for Barrett time.
Oh, you do? Let's hear it.
Do you have a Barrett time?
No, not.
I want to hear what would happen if we did have a Barrett time.
I think it's just the regular.
That's the regular one. That's not.
No, it's
roll.
Not.
Hey, Barrett.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
What's happening?
It wasn't updated.
No, nothing.
Well, room around.
Interrupt this skit to bring you.
Oh, it is different. Are you mixing stuff?
No, it had a record scratch in it.
That means it's time for. Yeah.
Did McGuff get to Barrett time too?
Yeah.
Wow.
He touched all of them.
Just a second. Yep.
He was trying to help.
It's a much more aggressive Barrett time.
He was trying to help. He was doing good things.
We stole the record scratch from, what was that show?
Barrett time on speed! Barrett time on speed!
What was the show where there's always money in the banana hut?
Arrested Development, yeah. Blue's Bananas, yeah.
In the banana stand.
Bananas and Banana Hut. I knew what you meant.
I did too.
I didn't even know the name of the show. You're giving me a break for misquoting it. But you knew what it was. It's like
I did
you could
know
always,
what it was.
Like if anybody mispronounces that actor's name in any number of ways, you'll know who you're talking about if they're talking about Benedict Cumberbatch. All right.
There's something for the Geek Gathering.
Oh, there is.
Yeah. Do you want to see what it is?
Sure.
All right.
Where did the CD come from?
Geek Gathering Alert.
Hello, girls and boys.
Party it up with the Technology Bytes crew this Friday. Log on to geekradio.com for more details.
But not actually this Friday.
No.
This is only a test.
This is only a test. This is only
and it's been a real Geek Gathering
a test.
So, that's funny. It's like he knew that we weren't going to be in the same place, so he didn't want to mention the name of where we were going to be. So he's just like... Go on to the website for more details.
Was this in our box, or did you have this at
No,
home?
I had it.
Okay.
I carried it in my bag for, like 7 years. And then I think last year or 2 years ago or something, I took it out when I was going to DEF CON. So it just kind of sat in my bedroom in a pile of stuff. And then today I was going through some things.
And I
found it, and I was like, so I put it back in my bag, and so I had it with me today.
And now the circle is complete.
Yes.
And so, like, you know, seven years later.
Wow.
Yeah, we'll just pretend that's from our ill-fated morning drive time version.
Just call if you're in your car, and we'll do tech support. And you can it'd be like a real tech support call when you call and you're not near the computer, which has happened so many times. There was an error message. I don't know what it said. It was some kind of error.
009 something.
I don't know. I just pressed OK anyway. What was wrong? God, I've had that call before.
All right. On with the nose.
The nose. All right. Well, so here's a... This is a quick... No, it's not quick. But a short segment on, I guess, how effed up on technology our government currently is. And multiple stories for that. Here's one that's an interesting one. People who want to visit the United States could be asked to hand over their social media passwords to officials as part of enhanced security checks. This is according to the country's top domestic security chief. Homeland Security Secretary John Kelly told Congress on Tuesday the measure was one of several being considered to vet refugees and visa applicants from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Quote, we want to get on their social media with passwords. What do you do? What do you say? He told the House Homeland Security Committee.
What are your PGP keys?
If they don't want to cooperate, then you don't come in. Never mind. I don't want to get too political.
You have to
come on one of these later ones. And then here's a good one. How about, you know, remember how we currently have sort of the problem of what influence was there on our election? And, you know, the concept of how clean are our elections is kind of important. Yes, well, House Republicans just voted to eliminate the only federal agency that makes sure voting machines can't be hacked. It's like, what are they, Bond supervillains? You know, the machines, this election they worked fine, so what's the problem? They'll work fine forever. No, but, it's called the Election Assistance Commission. And they are moving forward with the idea of getting rid of this commission. The EAC was created after the disastrous 2000 election in Florida as part of the Help America Vote Act to rectify problems like butterfly ballots and hanging chads. The committee that voted against this also voted to eliminate the public financing system for presidential elections dating back to the 1970s. So, just doesn't seem like the right thing to do at this point in time, technology-wise, given that we don't have, that the possibility that something untoward could happen
wouldn't be
with
prudent
one of our elections
at
is
this juncture,
rising, not declining, and not having anybody who's in charge of it just seems like a... From my point of view on this, it's not partisan. Because all it takes is for which side are the guys who hacked the machines, which side are they on? Who do they want to win? And that doesn't, there's no guarantees that it's who you like.
Barrett for president.
Like. Yeah, really.
It obviously wasn't Bernie Sanders guys.
I, for one, welcome our new mustachioed overlord.
So, and then here's a couple quick hits in the face from the FCC. I don't know if you've been following this.
Yes.
The this week they had their new thing. His name is Ajit Pai. Testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. under Trump's newly appointed chairman, Ajit Pai, the Federal Communications Commission spent the past week slashing many of the agency's previous efforts to make vital telecom services accessible to all. As a result, higher prices on everything from phone calls to downloads are already being handed down, starting with low-wage and imprisoned Americans. Last week, the FCC made it known that AT&T and Verizon are officially off the hook regarding that zero rating business over prioritized streaming content, which means where they where it's not a violation of net neutrality when they stream their own content for free to you, but you pay or you use up your limits when you stream somebody else's content.
Right.
The FCC also walked back several other efforts by previous leadership on Friday, rescinding recommendations for improving broadband infrastructure, because we don't need that, right? What a waste. Let's see, a white paper on reducing cybersecurity risk, because why would we need to reduce cybersecurity risk? That's just crazy. And a report on modernizing the E-rate program, among other things. Ars Technica noted in their article, which I guess they're quoting in Forbes, Pai has also vowed to overturn the FCC's net neutrality rules, which we'll get to in a minute. They took the opportunity to end longstanding efforts to curb the soaring cost of prison phone calls, which can easily hit the $1 per minute mark before a range of hefty fees are tacked on. So there's
captive
that.
Audience.
And then, yeah. And then, and then here's a real nice one. It's like, because the poors don't need no internet. They revoked approval for most of the already vetted subsidized internet plans for helping low-income individuals get online.
They wanted extreme vetting.
The CEO of the internet access and outreach nonprofit Everyone On explained by phone that the dropping of 9 provider partners from the agency's subsidized Lifeline program, established under President Reagan to boost economic participation, is already taking a toll on those most in need.
Who, just a second, who started this program? Who
President
was it started?
Reagan, that lefty,
that commie?
Lefty socialist pinko giving away the free stuff. This isn't, it's not like taking away somebody's Obama phone. This is taking away their Reagan phone. The Reagan phone line.
To me the whole thing with net neutrality thing has been weird. Like that whole political situation has gone through some weird contortions. Like, because when it first started, like, net neutrality had a certain definition and a kind of a very specific ideal behind it, and almost all people who were in tech supported the idea of net neutrality, right? Like, from an idealistic perspective, the idea that you don't, like, manipulate traffic to provide a benefit to one of your friends in order to make the competition look bad or to block people from going to certain types of sites because you control the pipe. You know, the idea is like, you just have a pipe and you don't filter what's in it. But ideally, and everybody was like, oh yeah, that's awesome, we love that, and the government's, they're trying to do some weird stuff, but all tech people, yeah, we're right on with this. This is a good idea. It's very ideal. But then, like, as it went, it wore on, like, all of a sudden, all these tech people, like, hardcore tech guys started, like, coming out of the woodwork saying, no, net neutrality is horrible. We already we already do what they're saying they don't want done. We already, and they started using quality of service, peering. They started using all these terms that are used for internet connectivity above the normal end user, right? It's not like last mile. It's higher up. It's right. Like peering between large, like level 3 and Time Warner or whatever. Like they have peering contracts where depending on how much bandwidth is used in each direction, they have to back pay each other if it becomes too unequal. So they started saying, no, this neutrality is not any good because we're already doing it anyway. And if we can't do this, then it will break the entire internet. And so then all of a sudden you got this schism of people who used to be for net neutrality, but now they're against net neutrality. But the definition of net neutrality from an ideal has kind of morphed. And so now you have two kind of tech camps that are fighting with each other. And I don't know. I feel like it's like the business people and government like manipulated the definitions and the scenarios to create these two camps to fight each other so that the businesses can kind of ride in the middle and get what they want. That's my opinion.
The thing is, we've had net neutrality has been the law of the land for about a year, and peering didn't go away, and all the things that that they said, we wouldn't be able to do that. That didn't happen. But now getting rid of net neutrality, the idea of what it could mean for consumers, more data-free offerings, expect more deals like AT&T's where users can stream DirecTV Now on mobile devices without it counting against their monthly limits. Who's against that? Well, nobody, but we'll talk about why that could be an issue later. Some content flows faster. Content providers in the future could make deals with ISPs to ensure optimum delivery of their video, music, or other content. Some content flows not so fast. When there's a fast lane, somebody's going to not be, if just drive on I-10, there's the toll lanes and there's the not toll lanes. And usually one is faster.
They've gotten almost like to the like Orwellian, like double speak stuff where, it's like everybody originally with net neutrality, everybody was like, no, net neutrality is important because otherwise the big companies will crush competition they'll keep the small companies from being able to get enough bandwidth to be able to start up a company to create competition because, whoever's in control will control all the bandwidth and keep the other people throttled, whatever. It'll squash competition, and we don't want that. We want an open internet where everybody has a voice and everybody has equal access to stuff. Now, you see the flip side people arguing that net neutrality will crush competition. Right, so it's like they flipped it into the complete opposite. So and they have their logic, they have their reasoning, but it's like both sides now are arguing that their opposition will crush competition and not allow startups to happen.
I guess and the thing to me though is we've had net neutrality, and I haven't seen nobody's gone out of business because of that. But the thing I see going forward though is, okay, well, so now on your mobile device, DirecTV doesn't count against your limits, but everybody else does. If Netflix wanted to be part of AT&T's deal where it doesn't count against your data cap, is that available? Is that open and available to them? Is there equality in that? Or does AT&T say, no, we own DirecTV, and so they get to be in for free and pay us nothing for it.
See, and so
everybody else, you can't even do it.
The anti-net neutrality people say
that stifles innovation.
That hasn't happened. Nobody's done that. Nobody has proof of that. That's just a conjectural thing.
that
they're trying to fight against. No, but they're saying it hasn't actually happened. Now, what they will say, though, is that companies like T-Mobile, for example, have binge on stuff, right? But that's not the providers, that's a content provider, right? That's not actually like an ISP. They're arguing it differently.
I still, the thing to me is just wait till you have to pay an extra fee or where your Netflix goes up, because the deal was bandwidth, you're providing bandwidth. When you hook up to your ISP, they give you the pipe and you get terms of service, like you're going to get X amount of bandwidth, and you paid for that. And when you go and, I've done the other side, when you get a server, you get bandwidth limits, you get a speed, the speed of your bandwidth, the amount, all those kinds of things. Well, and like, so you've paid to get on the internet, and then when you're cut, but now the new thing is when your server that you paid for all this bandwidth, or your farm of servers that you paid for the bandwidth on, when that connects up and it goes to somebody's network, say Time Warner, now Time Warner wants a taste. They want to put a toll on it and charge you because you have customers, because their customers want your stuff and they're in the middle. They feel like they have the right to now charge you extra. Now they're charging their customers for their bandwidth, so they're paying for that. And they're charging, you know, that you end up with the peering and that kind of stuff.
And that's,
you're paying to Time Warner already.
Although it does get into weird territory with peering, because if peering gets too lopsided, then one company's losing money because the other person is either shoving content or pulling content, you know, and it becomes unfair. They have to, like, renegotiate the peering contract, right? And so that's one of the things that the anti-net neutrality people say, is that specifically companies like Netflix have been very pro-net neutrality because it's good for them, because they have huge amounts of bandwidth that they're pushing down to, like, all these people, and they're not having to pay anything to get all that bandwidth
except
to all those
people.
Except
they are. They're already paying for it.
Except they and the people who are getting it are both paying already, and they just want more for the one in the middle. It seems, to me, it looks like an extortion scheme. Well, that's a really nice business you got
there.
Well,
it is an extortion scheme.
And you gotta, I noticed you've got to drive, your trucks keep driving past my house or driving past my business to do your deliveries. That'd be too bad if there was something happened where you couldn't, like, pass by.
I mean, peering arrangements are typically secret, but all of the Tier 1 ISPs effectively peer for free. They effectively have a, you know, like a industry-wide truce on peering. They don't pay for transit, because if one of them started charging the other one, the entire thing would collapse. And then big places like Netflix, YouTube, the guys who are pushing all the bits, they already have content servers that are co-located within everybody's network, so their load doesn't translate into additional peering traffic.
That's part of the way that they've gotten around a lot of that.
Yeah.
The peering stuff is that a lot of them at this point have...
They're all just co-load.
Big data centers that are right at the provider's...
And, I mean, frankly, putting that stuff on the edge, everybody wins anyway. That's good for everybody. It means you get faster Netflix, and it also means that, like, the transit costs are effectively eliminated, and there's no marginal cost tacked onto your bit delivery.
Well, and you may remember in the news this past summer, I reported on, or I found a report on it. Bandwidth is not costing them... is not costing these big providers.
No, I just misspoke. What I should have said is there is never a marginal cost on a delivery of a bit. That is a false equivalency. That does not happen. There is a sunk cost to construct the line, but the effective cost of a link from point to point is the exact same whether that link is 0 or 100% saturated.
It's now, also, you know, the other piece to this is the ISP that's the last that owns the last mile is the one that can really take advantage of the net neutrality issue, because you don't know how that's routing from Netflix to you, but they do know that if you're a AT&T customer, that it will go through AT&T to get to you because you're an AT&T customer, and so they can go to Netflix and say, look, you're running this much stuff through us, you owe us money. So, anyways.
Well, people have had issues with the last mile, as far as I know. Was it Comcast or Time Warner that was blocking P2P traffic for a little while? Like, they were just dropping, you know, this just only happened for a while. The BitTorrent users came out and said, hey, but they would actually get in. This was invasive. It's not like they're just saying like, hey, firewall, drop these UDP packets.
Can't download my Linux ISOs.
They were actually sending out handshakes to, like, seeds and things like that.
I remember this, yeah.
Yeah, and more or less than tying up those connections and just dropping them. So more or less it would come in, and it would give you more or less like a hub, like a hang-up signal on that BitTorrent connection. Yeah. You just hang up. And BitTorrent users were like, hey, we can't figure out what's going on. There were some developers that got into their things and said, hey, it's not on our side. We did push out changes, but it's not us. And it took some detective work, and that's what I want to know. You know, as far as being in IT, as far as doing networking stuff, when I put a packet on the wire, I need that packet to come out just like I put it in wherever I aim it. And that's what scares me about net neutrality
network
is the
management.
Fact that people could come in and, you know, take care of that. And again, you can encrypt stuff. There are ways around that. But, you know, I think, you know, drop something on the wire, get it off the wire.
Then you bring in DPI and you start looking at traffic shaping packet shaping where they don't have to decrypt your traffic. They can just guess based on behavior.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we do, too. You look at net flows and you don't – like it's the same thing when the government says, like, hey, we're not looking at your data. It's that metadata. It just gives
we
you
don't
the full
need to
story,
look at
too.
It.
We don't need to. You know, we don't have the time.
Well, the last one, and this one isn't posted at geekradio.com, but it came in as a tweet. When I went to Twitter to tweet out about the show coming in, there was a thing from the ACLU, and I don't know if – I didn't know this, and so it surprised me, but the Border Patrol has special rights within 100 miles of a border.
Correct.
Where they can, you know, if they have – they're supposed to have probable cause – but they can pull you over and they can search and do lots of things. A lot of constitutional rights are
suspended
reduced
at a border crossing.
And the thing is, though, so you think about that and you kind of go, okay, well, so there's a Canadian border, and so you imagine that, you know, being a place where the Border Patrol would do that, the Mexican border. Instead, imagine, take a big highlighter and go all around the outer edge of the United States, because the coasts are considered a border, and go in 100 miles.
Laptops at the beach were never a good idea.
If you look, that covers – that means the Border Patrol can do beyond constitutional things.
Around airports, too,
Houston,
actually.
Houston,
yeah.
Texas. The entirety of Houston is included in that. So – San Antonio, which is far away from the border.
Well, if you're not doing anything wrong, you got nothing to worry about.
Like, oh my God!
The thing is,
I just exploded.
When you go around the coast like that,
what are you hiding, Pete?
That is most of the population of the country.
Well, and the really funky thing about that is if you ever find yourself facing down a court order to decrypt your device. And if you do have something nasty on your device, you need to kind of have to – you have that equation in your head. Like, what's the penalty for noncompliance here? Like, can the judge hold me indefinitely for contempt, and is that worse than potentially the penalty for whatever it is that is or isn't on my device?
Can you just say you forgot your password?
But – well, what I was going to say is you don't necessarily have that option for judicial review or assistance from counsel at a border crossing. You do not automatically have the right to consult an attorney when you're facing down CBP.
Nobody would say that when you pull up to the deal where they're like, you know, welcome to our country, and, you know, where you're coming through directly from outside.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think – most people would not think of that including being 75 miles from Biloxi, Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a place where you would be at the border.
Potentially, because that's within that CBP
right,
area.
Right, within 100 miles of the coast.
CBP is the
Customs
and Border
Protection.
So
it's a very odd – the ACLU highlighted it.
But what's
because it is a very unusual concept.
But when you say border, wouldn't the border be where the international water border is?
No, this gets really complicated.
No. This is one of those where how the rule is interpreted is that the current
that it's actual land to
is
sea.
That it is from the and I guarantee you, if you're in a discussion when you're standing at mile marker 101 on whatever freeway going from the Gulf Coast up, that they're not going to.
You know what, Pete? You should just tell them you're a sovereign citizen and you're engaged in the act of traveling, and they have.
And that I'll only talk to the local sheriff.
The constitutional sheriff. I refuse to enter into color of law and maritime.
There's a lot out there, and the thing is that's not new. The 100 mile border thing is not new.
No.
So you may want to research that one yourself.
That's all of Florida, right? Florida's not 200 miles across.
Pretty much everything but Disneyland is, or Disney World. Or no, I guess we have a caller.
We do. Muhammad called back in. So we got
after 10 minutes, it rotated back around to the to us talking about his call. And
saying to call in. All right, Groove House.
Yes.
Who do we have?
All right, we're going to try Muhammad again.
Muhammad, you're on the air. You're on the air with Technology Bites. Bites.
Yeah, I have this Windows 7 on my laptop. It's an HP computer, and my desktop is you know, my son gave me this laptop, and the desktop is cluttered with so many icons.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not a whole lot computer literate, but when I go to, you know, install, uninstall program, there are so many of, it says 101 program installed, and I don't know so many of them, and I'm afraid what to delete and what not to delete, you know, uninstall. So that's one reason of calling you, and thanks for taking, you know, thanks for taking my call, and that's the question. Can you help me?
Well, it's going to be a hard thing to solve on a radio program, because we don't know what's installed on the computer, and we don't necessarily, you have to kind of look at the applications that are installed and make a decision as to whether or not they're an application that you use or not. So if you look at a program, if you look at your add remove programs, and you look at the different programs that are installed, many of them will be obvious as to what they are, and others may not be so obvious. So you may have to Google search to see what they are, or launch the program and see if it's something that you use.
Okay.
But, I can't tell you in the context of this show what to delete and what not to delete. You say your son gave you this computer?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And desktop is almost full.
You know what you can do with the desktop? You can take all the icons and you could create a folder and drop them in the folder to reduce the clutter.
That is a lazy way, and I am guilty of doing that every once in a while. I'll just make it, I'll call it like desktop folder, and then just grab everything in there, drag and drop it in there, and then at your leisure you can go through there and, you know.
So what are you up to at this point? Like
desktop
12?
And what's awesome is I actually have, and I've gotten better about it, but, you know, because hard drives keep getting bigger and bigger, so I'll have old desktops of old machines on new desktops. So I've got to go like, okay, that was desktop 5 two machines ago. Got it. So...
But, you know, so to reduce the clutter on your desktop, you could go through and just create a folder on your desktop and take all of those icons and put it in the folder.
Uh-huh. Yes, sir.
So uh-huh. That would reduce the clutter, but then you can open up that folder, and then many of these icons will go away if you uninstall the program that they're associated with. That's not everything. I don't know what your son put on the computer. I don't know what he had loaded. Have you consulted him to ask him, like, what you might need or what you might be able to clean up? Or did he just give you his
own computer?
Because they
might, I mean, you might look at the extension on the files.
He just gave me and he said, do whatever you want to do with it. Because he said it's full of viruses. You know, and
well,
I'm stuck with it. And so my second question is this. Mr. J. Lee has a business somewhere in Houston?
No, I do not.
Okay. All right.
That I don't provide computer services to the public, except when I'm on the radio or answering questions for my newspaper column. If you're looking for a computer tech or someone to work on your PC, there's a place in town called the Computer Hospital. I have had good experience with them. They don't pay us to be mentioned on this show or anything, but they're a good local tech company called the Houston Computer Hospital. And you might look them up online and give them a call. They have offices on Travis and downtown and another location I can't recall off the top of my head. But it sounds to me like maybe you're
full
not the
of viruses.
I would back
if
it
really
up.
Feel like it's full of viruses.
Well,
and there's those kinds of problems.
Let's listen to what he said. He's not very computer literate.
Yes,
and
right.
He is given a computer by his son that's full of viruses.
But his son said that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. My son said
it may not have.
But let me tell you a very little story. I was, my computer was open and I was trying to figure out which one to install. And suddenly, a very loud voice came from the computer, and it says, "We are from Microsoft, and we can."
That's a scam. Yeah. That's a scam. So my thought is that you should call your son and have him come get the computer and take it back. And then you should go to the computer store and buy yourself a new computer that is clean and has the minimal things loaded on it. And then install programs that you're going to use on it.
Or just have your son wipe the computer.
If he's computer capable himself, is your son technical?
No, not very technical. Can I wipe it clean? Is there a way?
I wouldn't try to do it yourself. I mean, Mohammed, what it comes down to is how much do you value your own time? Because this is a problem, a set of problems that you could spend a considerable amount of time dealing with. You know, how much is your time worth to you?
Or have your son do it. I mean, ask him why he doesn't love you.
Either.
Well, I know, but he could still put it back on him. Your son, if he gives you a virus-laden computer, I would have some other questions for him.
Yeah,
you know. Pitch it through his window.
But he may never see it again because his son may never wipe it and give it back to him. He gave him a virus-laden computer.
The problem, you know, we've had this conversation before. If you don't know much about computers, if you don't know a lot about computers, chances are a secondhand computer of questionable origin is not the proper computer to learn how to compute on. You're working from a deficit because you have a computer that has problems.
The computer hates you.
The computer's
like a $500 car.
The computers.
It never stays a $500 car because of all the other things you have to do.
The computer is already aligned against you. So, you know, the average person who is learning how to use a computer does it from a base, or should do it from a base of having a functional computer that's, you know, that the only problems it's going to have are the ones that you inflict on it. Not necessarily one that's been kind of, we don't know what your son's done. I don't know if your son browses questionable websites or if he installs pirated software. I don't know what he does. I don't know what this computer could have. Certainly there are things you could do to clean it up. You could run antivirus programs on it. You could scan it. But it sounds to me like you're not going to know what you're looking at or what you're doing. So you can pay someone to take a look at this computer and try to get it running properly, or you could use that money, because it's going to cost you probably a few hundred dollars with a technician to have that computer evaluated and fixed. Maybe, you know, $200 to $300 or more at your average computer shop. For $200 or $300, you could buy a brand new computer.
That's right.
Refurbs are really nice too. I was just at Micro Center and picked up like some really nice specs just for a router machine for like $100, and I was really surprised at what you got for $100. That was actually be cheaper just to get a version of Windows that way. You know, OEM, it's got the sticker on there than buying it.
But the thing
else is
that if you buy a new computer, then you buy something from one of the name brands like Dell or HP or whoever's selling computers these days, and you have a line of tech support. So you have the ability to call into their support line for assistance if you're having problems. And the other question really comes down to if you don't know much about computers, what do you plan to use the computer for? What is your intention? What do you need from a computer?
I'm not, you know, the plan was that I'm not going to use it. If I can clean this computer, I can give it to my daughter, and she can, you know, she just passed her real estate license, and she can install all her...
Is she technical in any capacity?
Who, sir? Me?
No, her, your daughter.
No.
Do you love your daughter?
get her a nice, new.
If you want to give her something that she can do her work on.
Well, I am a little bit technical. I can take the hard drive out. I can change the battery. I can install a program, and I can do all that. But when I look at what is installed on this computer, 50% of it I never even heard of it.
Well, you can
that's
start.
The part you can see. If it's full of viruses, who knows what else is there that's
right,
not going to show up?
Who makes the computer? What brand is it?
HP.
Yes.
It's HP?
Yeah.
Yes.
Did your son make or have, does he have the recovery disk? So is every computer you buy, you can have a recovery where you can put the computer back to the state it was when it was bought new? Do you know if he made those? Okay, you don't know. That's okay.
When I go to a computer, and then my recovery, I see this recovery D disk.
Okay, there's a recovery disk that has the recovery partition on it, which is the software that you would use to reformat the computer back to the original factory specs when it was new. That's what I would try to do. That's if I was, if this was my computer and it was given to me by my hateful son who doesn't love me, I would take it and just wipe it clean and start from scratch, you know, with just the base install of software. That way you know what you have. So there may be a recovery tool on the HP, and I'm trying to remember.
It's kind of like, hey, I had to replace the alternator in my car. Something was wrong. Here, Dad, here's the old alternator. Maybe you can clean it up and get it working.
All right. So
but believe me, I can replace the alternator.
Well, next time you replace your alternator, give the old one to your son as payback for this laptop. What opera is it, Windows 7 or Windows 10?
Windows XP. 7.
Windows ME. I know HP has a recovery. HP has an HP system recovery utility. And if you are you online, do you use the internet?
Right now the computer is open.
I'm not going to walk you through this on the air.
No, I know. You don't have.
No, but if you there's
somebody called in and mentioned, and I'm not fact checking. This could be alt news for all I know. But they said HP, I think when you're booting, if you hold down F11, it goes into the recovery mode where it allows you to like install from the recovery partition.
For HP?
Do you use the internet? Do you have access to the internet?
Yes, sir. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
All right. Do a Google search. You know how to use the Google?
Yes, sir.
All right. So search for HP system recovery. And there, if you do HP system recovery, they have a link from the support HP site that talks about how to do a system recovery in Windows 7 on an HP computer.
Okay, sir. All right.
That's what I would do. And then try to recover, you know, reset the computer back to the way it was when you bought it. And then maybe that'll solve most of these problems. But if you're looking for someone to help you with it or maybe try to help you get it cleaned up or do this for you, you could try calling HP. They may charge you a fee to walk you through this, but you might call HP support, look up their contact information, or you can go to a local computer shop like Computer Hospital or something like that in town.
I took that down. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your call.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Sure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Technology Bites will be right back.
And we're back.
After this vein explodes.
Shortest break ever.
No, I mean, I feel for people like that. I mean, it's the dilemma. It's that woman a few weeks ago who bought an iPad from a pawn shop.
Well, you don't want to waste it. Like, you don't want to be wasteful of the technology that you have, but sometimes it's like, just toss
the
it.
I guess the other thing, though, is especially for somebody who's mechanically minded, if somebody gives you a car with a lot of problems, then what you do is you kind of go, okay, I need to figure out what the individual problems are and solve them and, you know, fix the alternator and fix the carburetor and do this, you know, the injectors, whatever.
But you understand that those components
You don't have the ability on a car. If you get a crummy car, you can't just, like, hit the right keys and then it resets to factory new.
Now, that's
that
true.
Would be cool. And so, but people don't. They think about, and Windows
is totally
inappropriate for anybody but an expert to try and go in and unwind a screwed up Windows.
Well, even then, you can kind of like, if it was a Linux box, you can go into a server, you can go in, you can pull out parts, you can reinstall parts, or even like package managers to help you. But you know, if we're going to continue the car analogy, a Windows car, they've welded the hood shut, and they've thrown away the schematics, and they've locked you out of everything. And if you touch certain wires, it's going to deliver an electric shock, it feels like. It might be literally
on fire under there.
Yeah,
too.
I mean, you're getting into the registry at that point, and at that point, really, it is. It's almost easier just to push the new car button.
Well doesn't Windows 10 have like a?
It does.
A refresh, a sysprep, a sysprep style refresh button.
As far as I know, it does.
Yeah.
But Windows 7 doesn't. And so something to understand is that the computer is two things basically. It's the software
evil.
Load.
It's evil.
It's evil and it's dust. Merciless. Right. Now, it's the software load, which is something like we were talking about. You can reset it, you can refresh it, you can reinstall it, and that tends to work worse. And then there's the hardware component where you've got the hard drive, the motherboard, the CPU, and all of that stuff. And that hardware can fail, but it's the most common failure point on any computer tends to be the software. You know, you get malware installed, you get the computer infected, you accidentally delete critical files, or files become corrupted for whatever reason. But that,
well, if it's not the software, it's the wetware.
Well, part of the reason why Windows, you know, kind of finger quotes rots like that is because this is not a criticism. It's because the operating system, Windows 7, Windows 10, Windows 8, Windows whatever, even Windows XP, they're extremely complicated and not. I mean, they're, you know, extremely sophisticated collections of programs that are doing all kinds of stuff that we often take for granted. I mean, we've got these, you know, basically these just miraculous supercomputers that we live with day in and day out. If you are like me and you grew up in the DOS era, you know, this is just like amazing stuff. But they are, in fact, sometimes so complicated, and you install applications, and some applications are written poorly or by vendors that don't stick to standards, and they don't uninstall right, and you end up with sort of like this, you know, garage sale yard of an operating system where you've got, you know, there's a car up on blocks over here, and you can't use the driveway, and, you know, this is... Yeah.
And that's just the result of the people who are trying to do something nice.
Yeah.
They have no malice. So this is just the, like, friendly people who, I want to add this feature to the computer here at Microsoft, and they put something in there. Then you add on top the criminals and script kiddies and malicious people who have built things that are designing.
Right. Well, there's malicious software, and then there's just incompetent software. And sometimes they're indistinguishable.
Yeah.
Over the last 16 years, I've worked in software development, worked with software developers, and some of them are quite good, and they really know what they're doing. They understand how the operating system works, and they understand how to write software to interact with that operating system and produce the final result. And then there's those that, you know, they totally understand how to program something, but they don't know how to make it work inside the environment that it's going to have to work with other applications and stuff like that.
Well, even good developers have bad days. You know, they'll have projects they don't care about. They would have been up too long. They make mistakes. I mean, that's the thing. If you trust a computer to work the way it should, and you think, like, hey, it's a machine, it should just do what it should do, that's wrong. I mean, software is rife with mistakes. Most of the things that people do, we're fixing bugs. We make our own mistakes. I'm surprised any of this really works at all sometimes, honestly. So it's neat that stuff does work, but something doesn't do what it should do. It's probably, like Jay said, it's probably someone made a mistake at some point. It's not necessarily something you can control or fix.
No, that's true. But, you know, and also I noticed that, you know, there's a lot of just, you know, sloppiness in software development in terms of, you know, you can tell. I mean, I've worked with software developers, and I know how they think. I see how they interact with the world around them. And again, some of them are pretty good at it and some of them are not. And so they may write a piece of software that is absolutely amazing until you actually have to use it in production.
It runs on my machine.
It works for me. And they don't. You see where they don't do things. They don't consider, they don't have an exit strategy. So it's like they can't even envision that you would ever uninstall the program. So they don't write a very good uninstaller. So, you know, a lot of softwares are guilty of that. So you take a piece of software, you install it on your computer, you don't like it, and you remove it. And yet there are still remnants of it there. And so it's that kind of deterioration,
yeah, their
and kind
their
of
focus
rot.
Is to get it on the computer and working on the computer. Getting it off the computer is like something they'll get around to later.
This is a horrible thing to say. Yeah, I, as a developer, if you're already going to uninstall my software, I don't care about you anymore.
What about those 16 outdated libs that you had to install because they're your favorite libraries and you need them?
Oh, right? We just roll with that. I haven't cleaned out that file since. Yeah, the make dependencies is like rolling from 1991. We'll just give you everything because I'm too lazy to go see what libraries you actually need. You
know, this is why Docker is a thing.
The most indispensable programmer in any operation is not the 10x guy, not the guy who puts out beautiful code that's tested and works and all that, because he can be struck by a bus and his stuff all works right up to the last build that he did on his thing. The indispensable programmer is the guy who is the only one who knows how his stuff works, and barely that. Right? Because he, you know, that guy you can't get rid of him because he's the only one who can.
No, code. Actually,
although every other developer
code that he leaves behind,
everyone else in the office, I guarantee, wants to kill him though,
yeah.
Because there's nothing worse than maintaining that style of code and that kind of code.
I was going to say the really indispensable guy is the shadow IT dude on the third floor who's got a Microsoft Access database that, unbeknownst to anybody, the entire company depends on all of a sudden, and it's running on a 15-year-old Dell under an unused desk in the corner.
Original hard drive.
Well, which brings me to the last story from the news as we come up towards the end of the show.
Caller on line one wants to talk about some software stuff. Software comments and computer-related,
all
right. Well,
I'll mention this one real quick, and then we'll take the call. There's an article in Wired that I think that a lot of people might be very interested in. That's the headlines kind of says it all. The next big blue-collar job is coding. And their idea is that, you know, with these boot camps and with these other things, what if we regarded code not as a high-stakes, sexy affair, but the equivalent of skilled work at a Chrysler plant?
What? What about the rock stars?
That's effectively true.
Kinda.
Though,
it is, yeah. I was about to say,
it's basically right.
They said, these sort of coders won't have the deep knowledge to craft wild new algorithms for flash trading or neural networks. Why would they need to? That level of expertise is rarely necessary to a job, but any blue-collar coder will be plenty qualified to sling JavaScript for their local bank.
I don't disagree with that take at all, frankly.
Build a website.
Well, hell, I can build a website.
The article's a little bit...
Microsoft, what was that called?
Front page.
Yeah. The article's a little misleading.
Squarespace or Wix.
And that it's saying, like, hey, not everyone's going to be a Zuckerberg, but no duh. And actually, Zuckerberg wasn't that great of a coder. Now, Linus Torvalds can, you know, sling some assembly, but I wouldn't, you know, run Zuckerberg's code.
I would
code
call Zuckerberg
anymore.
a clever coder, but not necessarily a good coder.
It's hacky and not in a different kind of way.
So you can find a link to that at geekradio.com.
All right.
But the idea is if you want to get into coding and if you want to be a software developer, you don't have to be the rock star. There are much more people cleaning up rock star
or
developers' code than there are rock stars.
There's the guy writing the uninstall routine that the software sadly needed from the get-go. All right, Groovehouse.
Yeah.
Who do we have?
All right, up next, Michael's got a few comments.
Hey, Michael, you're on the air with Technology Bites.
Hey, how are you guys doing? I listen to y'all show pretty frequently.
No refunds.
Yeah, no, I'm a mechanical engineer. I work for a contractor for NASA, and I'm installing a console trainer that I helped design for doing some testing for their new capsule, the CST-100, that's going to ferry astronauts from ground to station.
Woo, go Boeing!
And I'm installing it in their software integration room, and so I work with these guys, or I sit next to these guys, you know, a lot, and it's pretty funny watching them sit there and just hash out software, and they do like pad abort tests and docking tests, and they do all this stuff every day, and it's strenuous. It's, you know, there's a lot that goes to it. I mean, they're just running tests every day. I mean, those guys are up there day and night, you know, whenever the servers are open, those guys are up there. So it's pretty interesting hearing you guys talk about it and doing it. But I personally don't do it. I just do it. I'm, you know, mechanical engineer, but, you know, it's just kind of trying to put a little personal note on it.
I would assume their stuff, that's pretty high stakes. I mean, you've got lives, you know, you've got high dollar equipment. I think your average coder that's knocking out an Office product, if it compiles or if they don't get any errors, hey, let's ship or let's put that out there.
There's not like the beta version of this software sending a man to the moon.
There's an article, and I read it, and I've brought it up from time to time. You can read it on fastcompany.com. It's an old article, but the title of it, I've memorized it. The title of it is called They Write the Right Stuff, and it's about the... I think the folks who do this are, I think it's about SAIC, but it's about basically the coders who were writing the backup flight software for the shuttle and the process that they go through to guarantee bug-free code. And it's actually a fascinating article because it goes into, like, there's all the common assumptions that you make as a developer about how code has to be done, you know, and you gotta, like, do a scrum and do all these agile stuff, and then you have to have stand-up meetings and you have to have crunches and everything, but the absolute bug-free code that for the BFS stuff is actually done very carefully with massive amounts of change control, very tiny commits that are considered right. very carefully. And it's done by people who do typically like an 8-to-5 workday, not like a long yeah. crunch, crazy coding session, because that's right. where you get errors.
Mm-hmm. You're like your typical people, you know, they have everything backed up on servers and they have, you know, engineering data management systems to help, you know, make sure that they know what their last change was and their last revision and stuff like that.
Yeah, change control. Yeah, not on GitLab. Change control is massive in an area like that, and you've got to do it. Documentation and change. In fact, they said that the documentation and change control revisioning for the software is like 400 times as long as the software, which actually wasn't very long.
Yeah. So I got my dad personally does Orion software for the Orion capsule, and they're going to end up using the SLS, the Space Launch System, for that. And you guys should really read into, if you have time on the air, I don't know, but there's a few articles you can find at like space.com and a few websites that, you know, go into what they actually went in, how the mythology that they used to start building the software for that. And essentially they took other people's flight software and just started chopping it up, and they're getting into a ton of problems with it. And it's severely over budget, severely behind schedule. I mean, it's really an interesting article to see how they actually start to go about the problem of building a new software for a new launch system. So I think that would be like really something cool that you guys should look into. I mean, it's well worth the read.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that tip. We'll definitely look into it.
All right, man. You guys have a good one.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call. Astronauts.
They're just as, you know, think about it, though. NASA is just as thorough on the mechanical side. You know that they don't get to the end of assembling some component for, you know, launch vehicle or whatever, and have like two screws left over, like whenever I like fix anything on a car.
No, typically not.
You know, they're not going to go. They're not, oh well, it'll work. Come on, you know, get Bob. He knows how to tape everything together.
No, no, that was actually a problem in the Block 1 Apollo command module, and that's why. I mean, you know, that's why Gus Grissom and Ed White and Roger Chaffee died. Essentially, is because of engineering failures and failures to do a lot of different things.
Hey, we got one last call coming in. Do we want to take that? We got time?
I got to screen it first.
Oh. Well,
screen it.
I'll screen
it. Do we have time? What do we have, like 2 minutes? Yeah,
two minutes. Never mind. Yeah, sorry, we're out of time.
Yeah, we only got like 2 minutes. We can do like the fastest call ever. Like, caller, go ahead. What's your problem?
It never works like that.
I got this.
That just
buying
drags
your computer.
Dumpster diving Dave.
The computer hit me in the head when I was walking down the street.
I tripped. You know, I was actually, you know, to close it out, I actually found, like, a couple of years ago, found a laptop, like, laying in the ground.
It's a trap!
It was missing the battery and, of course, had no charger, so, but it, everything else looked completely sound.
You turned it
laptop.
On, and it was an operating system you'd never seen before, and... No, it was from the future.
I went on to eBay or Amazon or something, found a power charger for it, bought it. And fortunately, when I found the laptop, it had a little yellow sticky note with the password. So
perfect.
There was absolutely no revealing data on there that told me anything about who owned it, but it had an operating system, it had Windows 8 on it, and it was a completely functional laptop.
That's just still weird. Someone must have put that on top of their car and forgot about it.
There's
or I mean, how does that wind
out?
A
fat bald guy finding a laptop. It's got over a million views.
Yeah.
No, it was very strange to find it, you know. And I understand you. I thought about leaving it, but I was like, I can't do that.
A friend of mine found a GoPro camera by the side of a back road.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, he looked around. I mean, this place, it was really kind of out, sort of nowhere. So he took it home. He already had a GoPro. He hooked it up to look at the video to see if he can figure out
who owned it.
And there's the video of the guy kind of hooking it up to his car. You know, he was doing it, hook it up where it's looking forward on the car. And then he sees the next thing is the guy driving along that road. And then the camera falling off the car and rolling around to the side of the road.
Didn't catch a freeze frame of the license plate as it drove away?
Nope.
A million views on YouTube.
All right. Well, that music tells us it's time to wrap things up. So we're going to wrap things up now and make our way out of the radius. We're going to beatbox our way out of the studio.
Virtual box, please.
You've been listening to Technology Bites. I'm Jay Lee.
I'm Peter Hughes.
I'm Flicted.
I'm Barrett.
I'm Link.
And he's
Groovehouse.
Screen in the columns.
On Saturday, February 18th, the HBCU Truth and Reconciliation Oral History Project will offer the Houston community of color a day of healing through storytelling. Students from colleges and universities that sponsor the project will conduct interviews with and record the experiences of those who have suffered racial discrimination. Interviews take place from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Texas Southern University Law Center, 3100 Claiborne Street, Houston, Texas 77004. Interviewees must schedule an interview time and arrive 1 hour in advance. For more information, contact Project Director Reverend Steve Miller at 713-557-6520 or visit HBCUOralHistoryVideoProject.org. KPFT Houston.
Many companies will match gifts made to nonprofit organizations. A matching gift from your company will help KPFT preserve independent music, arts, news, and views for generations to enjoy. Just make a gift to KPFT this hour at kpft.org. Then contact your human resources office for eligibility requirements and to obtain a matching gift form. Many companies match the gifts of retirees, spouses, and surviving spouses, too. Just fill out the employee portion of the form completely and send the form to KPFT, Attention Matching Gifts, 419 Levitt Boulevard, Houston, Texas 77006. Your gift to KPFT could double if your company has a matching gift program. Your help makes a difference.